Here it is, a Saturday morning in CCO land, this one at the Minnesota State Fair. Still time, though, for our wine chat with our friend from Haskell's, Ted Farrell. Ted, good morning.
Good morning, Denny. How are you doing today?
Well, I'm doing fine. I was trying to think what the wine would pair with Tom Thumb Donuts. I haven't come up with anything yet, but...
Well, I think you'd want to go something kind of sweet with the Tom Thumb Donuts, or for a matter, just, you know, it doesn't have to be a wine, maybe a little Irish coffee.
I like that idea even better, especially in a, you know, it's 59 degrees. It's very fresh this morning, a nice cool morning. What is on your schedule to chat about this morning?
Well, it is so upside down, like you say. We're having, you know, we had state fair weather about 3 months ago,
yeah,
and now
sure.
We're having springtime weather. Maybe there's something to that magnetic pole shifting around.
Who knows? But again, I'm looking at the forecast. It's going to be a great week. I think we're going to see some record crowds here, no doubt.
Without a doubt. And, you know, I was over at the fair on Thursday and did my kind of walkabout and go to my old standard. You know, you did the turkey sandwich, which is just to die for, your mini donuts. But the one thing that you cannot miss, and I think it's the best thing, in my humble opinion, at the fair, is the Gizmo sandwich up on Machinery Hill. It is basically an Italian sloppy Joe, and it is so delicious. You know, they get the little marinara sauce, ground-up sausage, ground-up hamburger, a little mozzarella cheese melted on a bun, and it's so delicious. And the reason why it kind of sparked my interest on that, because ironically, this week we just got a huge shipment in of different Chiantis from the area of Tuscany. Now, Tuscany is a wonderful region right outside of Florence. It's in between the city of Florence and Siena, the two big cities, and it's a large region. They carry the actual area of Tuscany itself produces about 15 to 20 million cases of wine a year. And then inside of that area, you have Chianti. Now, Chianti is kind of the king of that region. Everybody knows Chianti. And they've been making wine in that region for eons. They have relics back to 800 B.C., where the Etruscans were making wines. And even the Greeks and the Gauls really noticed how great the wines were. And the Romans were quite proud of it. And eventually you went into the Dark Ages. And much like a lot of the wine industry in Europe, you know, a lot of that winemaking technique was saved by the monasteries. Eventually, landowners took hold of it, and they did a little interesting kind of sharecropping arrangement that they did in that area called mesadria. And mesadria means half. And so the landowners would provide the land and then also the tools to make it, but then also the peasants working the field got half of the crop. And so that eventually evolved into a society in Florence that were the merchants of the wine, and it traded it out. So Chianti has a rich, rich history. And then in about the 1800s, they kind of solidified under Baron Ricosoli the kind of formulation of what a Chianti is. And a Chianti has to have at least 75% Sangiovese. And then there's about four other indigenous grape varietals that can be blended in there. Ironically, two of the grape varietals that you could blend in there are the Malvasia or Trebbiano, and those are white grape varietals. And over time, the winemakers kind of want to phase that out because, you know, when sometimes people think of Chianti, they think of that kind of oblong bottle with the little ratafia wicker on it and most likely a red candle on it in your favorite Italian restaurant. And oftentimes, in years and years ago, maybe the best thing that was ever put in that bottle was that red candle because they put in so much white wine, it wasn't too terribly good. The reason why they put that ratafia around the bottle wasn't so much the aesthetic, it was practical purposes. What people did in those little villages when they worked in the field so hard, they didn't have very good refrigeration nor styrofoam coolers or whatever. They would wrap those bottles up with ratafia. They would put the tie a rope to the bottle, put that bottle in the city well, and it would chill the wine. And then the ratafia kept it cool when they would go out to the fields and work away. And at lunch, they would break, open up that bottle of wine, and the wine was still cool and delicious and enjoyable. So the Chianti's wonderful, wonderful wines, especially there's something about it with that tomato sauce and that marinara. It's just wonderful. And the two wines that we just recently got in is from my friend Luca Innocenti at the I. Veroni vineyards. Now, they've been making wine for their family for about 150 years, but really only commercially in the last 25. And you're seeing that a lot throughout Italy, where a lot of these folks have been doing it for so long and then now deciding, instead of selling their wines off to a big co-op or some kind of conglomerate, or only simply sell the wines down to their family restaurant or Uncle Luigi up in the hills, they would now are taking it on themselves to kind of branch out, get their wines across the world. And these Iberoni wines, Denny, are something to be reckoned with.
Oh, just the sound of it. Plus, you know, you talk about that area, and I love that area of Italy, too. Plus the wine.
Without a doubt. You know, the food is so fantastic. And it's still a region, even though a lot of the Brits have kind of trampled around there, and they had famous movies of Under the Tuscan Sun and et cetera. But it's still an area that hasn't really been properly discovered the way other parts of Europe have. But it's so wonderful. You know, the food is so rustic, but you know, Luca and his wines, he has several different expressions. And one thing that's kind of fun that I would highlight, you know, especially I'm a little bit behind since we don't have that hot, hot fair weather that we do. But my friend Luca makes a Vermentino that is just to die for. Vermentino is a lighter style. Now, this is a white wine, so it's not a Chianti, but this is a nice, light, white wine that is so crisp, a little bit of citrus to it, but it's so refreshing and elegant where, you know, if it was one of those hot days, you came back and you'd have that, and it just screams seafood. They do make a little bit of white wine, but, you know, the Italians are still per capita the number one consumers of red wine in the world, but they do make a trickle of white wine here and there, and they really need to kind of get a better marketing department on it, because that Vermentino, I had a little bit of that last night, came home, it was nice and chilled, we were sitting on the deck, it was crisp and clean, and most importantly, it's very affordable. It's only about $12. Now, I do have a shipment coming in. I'm not exactly sure if it's in our shelves, but our shores have some bottles of it in and around. But Luca also makes a fun Toscana wine. Now, the Toscana is a little bit of a variation. You know, if you want to call it Chianti, you have to follow that recipe of a minimum of 75% and then the other grape varietal. But when a lot of the winemakers, you know, wanted to broaden out and use other grape varietals, the Bordelais-style grape varietals, but they couldn't call it Chianti, so they declassified it and called it Toscana and Rosso Toscana, which just means red Tuscan wine. Very simple. But I had a little bit of this last night. We did a little takeout pizza, and this Toscana, it's the cepage on it, or the blend, it's about 60% Merlot, which is kind of ironic in that area, and then 30% Sangiovese. So it's a lighter style wine, but, oh, it's just so elegant, and it matches up so well with food, especially that, you know, with that little bit of acidity on the tomato sauce, that a little Toscana. And, again, it was only about $14 a bottle, so approachable and get the structure. But then Luca also makes some great Chiantis as well. You know, that follow all the recipes. But you do see a lot of the winemaking in Chianti fade away from some of those classic other varietals where they just really want to ramp up. In some cases, his Chianti, his Kona, is 100% Sangiovese, which is within the rule. You just have to have a minimum of 75% Sangio. And he decided with that one in particular that his Sangiovese was so good that he would just go with it. There's another little area right outside of that area called Bulgari. Now, Bulgari is a very interesting little place. You know, they made some Chianti-style wines, but what made that area very famous, very, very famous, is the wine Sassicaia. And the Marquis de Roqueta was a very interesting fella, where he actually was one of the pioneers and planted Cabernet in that area. And he made Sassicaia, and really it was for his own consumption at home. And then it was in the 60s that he maybe decided to go and broaden out and sell his Sassicaia. But this was a wine made for him that he liked in his little estate. And people really realized, wow, that's a great bottle of wine, even though it's Cabernet, it's not our local Sangiovese. But he had a problem calling it something. So they developed a term called Super Tuscan. And this was a little brainchild between himself and the other Marchese, and the Marchese Antonori, as far as let's call it Super Tuscans. And then this category has been devised and they're bigger wines, but the Bulgari area is a wonderful area, and they do make a couple fun Bulgaris that we just got in. They're very similar to the Chianti, but they're a little bit more robust. You do see them a little bit in a higher price range because, again, the Bulgari region is a little bit more of the high-rent district. So those can jump into the 25, 30. And if you're dealing with Sassicaia, I mean, you're talking wines that are $200, $300 a bottle depending on the vintage. That's a whole different critter. But the Marchese's interest in that particular region really sparked people to, you know, invest there, to dig in, make some great wine. And it's a great way to try an affordable Bulgari with some of these wines from my old friend Luca Innocente. But dominated by Cabernet, might have a little bit of Merlot, and they might round it off with some Sangio as well. But just delicious wines. And, I mean, it would be terrific if we could have a little bit more wine consumption at the fair. But, you know, it's a little bit tricky to do that. They do have the Minnesota wine growing section over by the Aghort building. And, you know, you can take a little sip of what the United States has. But, I mean, these Tuscan wines, especially kind of drilling up that gizmo sandwich. Oh, man, I wish I had a bottle of this Kona Chianti from my friend Luca, because I don't think I would have left the fair. I think I just would have sat on the park bench and watched the day go by.
Well, you know, with this kind of weather, and it's 59 degrees here at the fair, that kind of goes with this crisp. I, you know, like you said last week, it was really hot temperatures, and here we are with 59 degrees. That wine would be perfect for this kind of weather. In fact, we had a question about from the fair about Chianti, since you're talking about that region. Can Chianti? This gentleman wanted to know: are Chiantis able to be cellared, and if not, why not?
Oh no, they can be cellared. You know, depending on the Chianti, you can cellar those away easily 5 years. And in some cases, you can stretch them out a little bit longer. Nowadays, you know, they do get some good oak exposure, so they do have the structure. And the way they're making them gives them cellarability easily up to 10 years. So you can definitely do that, you know, but it's also kind of fun just to sit down and crack one open right away and not wait. But 5 to 10 years would not be difficult to do, except for the temptation of cracking one open between now and then.
And why wait, right? Why wait? What else can we finish with? I know we're just about out of time, and I want to tell folks that Haskell's, and I'm thinking of all the new folks that not only are CCO listeners, but maybe here at the fairgrounds itself, about Haskell's. Just give us a little bit of thumbnail history about how long Haskell's has been with us.
Well, Haskell's has been in the Minnesota culture for 91 years now, Denny, and maybe a little bit before that. During Prohibition, the Haskell's family was maybe selling a few things illegally here and there, but we've been doing that. And the old story was Fritzy Haskell did not like the liquor industry. They were all the gangsters and criminals. And she wanted to try something different. So Benny gave her $50,000 and said, why don't you go buy some wine and sell it to your friends? So she traveled over to Europe a long, long time ago. And we have pictures of her in 1936 gallivanting all throughout France, buying up wine, bringing it back here to Minnesota to serve everyone's needs, as far as whether it's a great wine for a dinner or a champagne for celebration, or just something to consume on a daily basis. And we've been doing that. My father purchased it from the Haskell's in 1970, and it was just one little store down on 7th Street right in downtown Minneapolis. And we've since expanded all throughout the metro region. You know, our city has gotten bigger, our footprint's gotten bigger, so Haskell's had to get bigger. And so we have 10 locations all throughout, and we still kind of travel the world to try to find the best wines at the best values for all the Minnesotans to enjoy.
Absolutely. I remember that one store. In fact, one day, Charlie Boone, my late friend, said, "Say, how'd you like to have lunch?" "Great." And it was with Sergio Mendez. And he stopped off at the store because he wanted to bring his own wine to the restaurant to have for lunch. And I remember that so well. Ted, we're just about out of time. Now, are you going to head to the fair at all this week?
Well, I was there earlier on Thursday and did all the checkoff list. I might go back a second time, but, you know, at least I can say I'm done and going then. And I should include on that quick, Denny, yeah. Haskell's is so old that even Sid Hartman was a kid as a print boy running the errands for the printers. So shows you how long we've been around. Sid was buying it, maybe illegally, but they didn't have age limits back then. But Sid would buy liquor for all the guys at the newspaper when he was just a paper boy.
What a great story. Ted, we got to run. Let's do this again next week.
I look forward to it, Denny.
Thanks so much. Ted Farrell from Haskell's.